With me is Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, and Executive Director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, a Houston-based think tank. He's also author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. He also contributes op-ed pieces to the SoCal News Group. Joel, good to have you with us again.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
So your thoughts about Farhad's contention that to be truly progressive, the city, the dense urban space is the logical and consistent expression of that.
Well, that article had so much garbage in it. It was, you know, they ought to take it out to the ocean. First of all, when he talks about dense urban areas being the drivers of the economy, we have to remember there's something called geography. Most American jobs aren't located in dense urban cores. They're located in suburbs, about 80% both jobs and population. So that contention is sort of wrong. The second thing is, the opposition to SB 50 was pretty broad. It wasn't just a bunch of rich people in Brentwood. It was really, a lot of it was in places like South L.A., and I know because I've actually spoken to the people, South L.A., East L.A., areas that felt that they would be greatly threatened. The bigger issue, I think, in many ways is that, well, there are two big issues. One, we really need to be looking at what kind of housing we are building. If you're building, what we're building now when we build the density, we've been building lots of density, we're building studio one-bedroom apartments that are expensive. I don't know what problem that solves, but it certainly doesn't do much. The reality is our problem in California is we're losing our middle class and we're losing families. L.A. had the biggest drop in the number of children of any metro in the United States, big metro in the U.S. So, you know, building larger units, whether it's single-family houses or townhouses, seems to be what we really need. We don't need a lot of, you know, little units for, you know, hipsters who are going to live in them for a year and then move. The other thing is there are enormous opportunities to build housing in our cities and in our suburbs, one obviously on the periphery, but also we're going to have this enormous tsunami of redundant retail space, strip malls that are not in anyone's neighborhood, already have the infrastructure, and are going to be redundant and where we can be building housing. This is starting to happen already. That's something that we should have a policy from the state to encourage localities to allow for housing to be built in those places. And then in the study we just did at the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, we found in Chicago, Dallas, and L.A., large tracts of undeveloped, abandoned land, again, where we could build things. We don't have to go into middle and working class neighborhoods and essentially transform them into places of dense, expensive housing. I don't see where that's progressive, but, you know, then again, I don't call myself a progressive either.
All right. Joel Kotkin with us, Chapman University, the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, contributes weekly op-eds to the SoCal News Group as well. Again, I'd like to hear from you what you think about Farhad Manjoo's piece in today's New York Times, in which he argues that the sort of ultimate expression of progressivism is with highly dense urban areas, that's much more egalitarian, that's the ideal way that we live, the carrying capacity is left less, it's environmentally friendly. What do you think about that? Is it possible to be a progressive and not hold that as the ideal vision? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us from the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA, research professor Paul Ong. He's the director of the Center for Neighborhood Knowledge at UCLA as well. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning, Larry.
So do you think that Farhad has it right that it's inconsistent to fight the higher density expansion into historic single-family neighborhoods and be a progressive?
I think there's a huge problem. I think you could be a progressive, but you have to be a progressive that's committed to making the kind of sacrifice that's needed to make the transition. I think part of the problem is everybody is approaching this looking for the perfect solution, and that has become the enemy of the good in terms of moving forward. Clearly, I agree with many of the comments earlier. The transition in terms of any change can be detrimental to neighborhoods such as South L.A. So one of the limitations of legislation is that I think it needs more attention in terms of protection of renters' protections. In terms of during the transition, how do we make the benefits benefit everyone? I think there's also another problem is that although we are increasing the supply of housing, it's not adequate. If you only have marginal increase in supply, it's going to stay with those with the greatest demand and greatest income. And there's very little trickle down. There's lots of latent demand, for example, where I'm living temporarily now in San Francisco, lots of latent demand for our high earners, high income. So if you only have a limited supply, new supply, it's not going to deal with our housing crisis. I do agree with the argument that given climate change and California's initiative to deal with climate change, we need to have the opportunity to move to denser, more efficient urban development. The legislation doesn't force that. What it is doing is allowing that to happen by getting rid of the NIMBYism barriers that we've been facing. We inherited a zoning regiment from decades, if not centuries ago. What's appropriate back then is certainly not appropriate today.
Well, I think some of these communities, though, have had quite recent neighborhood plans that have been put together for the kind of character that they're looking for, the mix of retail to commercial to residential. So I understand that, you know, some of these might not have redone their plans for a long time, but other of these neighborhoods have fairly regularly come back and looked at those plans. I want to hear from residents. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Mark in Woodland Hills. This is an issue certainly in your community. What do you think?
Yes, I live in Woodland Hills, and we actually had a meeting of the Woodland Hills Homeowners Association last night and spoke about this directly. To the question of whether or not the plans have been updated, Woodland Hills does have a new plan. It was ratified, and they're in the middle of building a new city center now. They call it Woodland Hills 2035. That is going to be high density. There are several buildings that are going up now. I live in a single-family home in Woodland Hills, and I believe that it should be my right to live in such a place. I chose to live there rather than downtown Los Angeles or New York or San Francisco because of the character, because of the feel, because of the energy of that place. And I don't think that the state should force me to watch high density go up across the street from me just because it can.
Mark, let me ask you, do you consider yourself a political progressive or someone who's more moderate or conservative?
I do consider myself to be a progressive. I don't agree with all of the tenets of the progressive platform. I don't think there's really one group that I would identify with 100%.
So the argument that Farhad Manjoo puts forth in today's New York Times is the argument that essentially the life that you chose in purchasing your home, a particular kind of single family neighborhood, that really that's not consistent with progressive values, that environmentally, transportationally, in providing access to people to have more affordable housing, that really in the long run is not sustainable, that it is the dense urban model that is the way that we should all live to be consistent with progressivism. Your response to that?
I don't think that one precludes the other. I think part of the reason that we enjoy life here in the United States is that we have choice. And I think that some of the arguments that say, well, we're running out of space, we're not running out of space, not by any stretch of the imagination. We may be running out of space in already developed areas. But this idea of even the huge complexes that are being built in my area, These are not going to be available to the average person.
All right, Mark, I appreciate it very much. Let me go back to Paul Ong of UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. So how do you get this sort of, you know, more egalitarian, different income levels are housed that Farhad writes about in his piece? Because when I look at Manhattan, when I look at San Francisco, these are among the most expensive cities in the world, because despite having the high density. How do you get to what Farhad describes?
I think on the egalitarian front, I do respect the fact that single-family homeowners have a right to choice and have a right to try to pursue their lifestyle. I think what we need to do is balance that off, that those who with more limited income, limited means, they should also have the right to pursue housing, affordable housing. And it's how you balance that. If we have artificial restrictions on the ability to supply housing, particularly at the low end, then we're not egalitarian. We're not providing the same set of opportunities to pursue people's dreams and so forth. And again, if you're low-wage worker and so forth, we have a system of zoning. We have a system of restrictions. We have NIMBYism that makes it very difficult to give the same set of opportunities. I would prefer to get rid of some of the restrictions and to see if we could supply through market means and also through state support for affordable housing, that we give the options to those who could least afford it.
Okay.
So is density equity? It's partially. It's not the full answer, but certainly.
But it takes us further on that road, as you see it.
Yeah.
Paul Ong, UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs, Professor Joel Kotkin of Chapman University and the Center for Opportunity Urbanism. Joel, your response to what Paul was just saying.
Well, I agree with some of what Paul's saying, but I think that first of all, when we've done the studies on inequality, core cities, the more dense areas have much greater inequality than the suburbs and the exurbs. I think, you know, what we're doing is we really should start thinking about places like the Inland Empire, which are is the one area that's growing. You know, L.A. County, of course, is losing population now. And how do we accommodate the aspirations, not just of the lower income people, which I think Paul addresses, but also the aspirations of upwardly mobile people who would like to buy a house, particularly young people who, you know, at this stage, the chance of them buying in most of Los Angeles and certainly most of Orange County is pretty negligible. So we have to start thinking about how we can create all sorts of different kinds of development, particularly in places like the Inland Empire, which are very much demographically vibrant. And we also have to start thinking again about all the opportunities that exist inside our cities, land that's not being used, land that's redundant, retail. We're not even addressing those opportunities. And the idea of going in and saying that here's your single-family neighborhood and now speculators can come in and do whatever they want, well, that's kind of a violation, I think, of people's expectations and why you bought the house in the first place. And so, I mean, if you bought a single-family house, like I do a lot of work in Houston, which doesn't have zoning, they have covenants where, you know, certain areas are controlled, and you can't build certain kinds of housing. But in other areas, people buy houses in areas which are zoned that they can go pretty much as dense as they want, and you buy that house for a different reason. You buy it more for speculative purposes. What worries me are the sociological impacts of going in and ruining stable, middle, and working-class neighborhoods on the one hand. And on the other hand, I agree that there has to be more housing options, and particularly for working-class people. The problem is going to be that right now construction of such housing is so expensive that there may not be enough money to make it happen. I don't think it's – when you talk to the market-rate people, very few of them think that there's going to be a great market opportunity in building apartments for poor people. So, you know, how we do that, I really think is, you know, something that we ought to be thinking about. as opposed to building a bunch of expensive units in Brentwood that will be used by yuppies. I mean, solving any problems.
Let me reset where we're at for those who've just tuned in. If you're just with us, we're talking about a piece in today's New York Times by frequent Air Talk guest. He's an op-ed writer for the Times, Farhad Manju, where he takes direct aim at progressives who fought SB 50, which was billed in Sacramento, died last week in committee. It would have allowed for development of higher density structures in areas otherwise zoned for less dense single-family homes and the like. And Farhad, in his piece titled America's Cities Are Unlivable, Blame Wealthy Liberals, he says that creating dense, economically, socially diverse urban environments ought to be a paramount goal of progressivism. Cities are the standard geographical unit of the global economy. Dense urban areas are quite literally the real America. So he's advocating that to be consistent with progressive values, that a city like Los Angeles, for example, really needs to remake itself in a much more dense environment, in sort of the days of the single family home with a front and back yard, that those days are really done environmentally, economically, and in terms of equity. So my question for you is, do you endorse that premise that Farhad writes about today or not? 866-893-KPECC. Katie in Toluca Lake, I understand this is hitting quite close to home for you.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on. In our neighborhood, all of our like four-unit 1950s little apartment buildings are being destroyed to put up these big condos, which now we can't afford. I'm a senior. And, you know, these little units are rent controlled. So we are all getting displaced and there's nowhere for us to go, not only because the rents have increased so dramatically, but, you know, they're not putting us back in these condos that they built at affordable prices.
And you're in an area that already allows this under zoning laws.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's up and down every street, and there's, you know, literally seniors out on the street with their bags going, now what?
Professor Paul Long, how do you create more units, denser housing, and protect the gates?
I think those are not necessarily mutually exclusive goals. I think one of the problems is with any policy is implementation. And certainly for SB 50, I would like to see much more protection for our existing tenants. I think there is always a problem in our market economy during transition is that it moves towards those who are more privileged and have higher income. And it displaces people and it hurts people who don't have either the political or economic needs in terms of achieving their own goal. So as we make this transition, and I do truly believe we have to have the opportunity to make the transition. Legislation is not about forcing the transition. It's about giving the opportunity to make that transition to denser development. That as we move in that direction, we got to be mindful of the fact that it quite often, if left to its own forces, hurts people. And so I would like to see as we move in that direction in terms of legislation and policy, not only a policy that increases the opportunity and potential for densification and other efficient development,
I guess
that we be mindful of protecting people at the same time.
I guess the question is, how do you do that short of the state of California saying we're going to pay the rents for people, which, you know, I don't think we're going to see legislation to that effect. So unless you're in some way going to subsidize people's rents, how would you do this if there's not the economics for developers to build low-income housing?
Well, part of it is part of the legislation is how do you grant development rights and provide us incentives at the same time, you know, take advantage of the additional incentives, the additional economic gains, and redistribute it in terms of developing affordable housing. And developing affordable housing doesn't necessarily have to be a new one. It's also you could use those sort of resources in terms of additional development, additional incentives to developers to protect existing units or help people transition from existing affordable units into new affordable units. So if the legislation is about opening up opportunities for development, and in doing so, how do we take advantage of that additional development in terms of shifting some of the benefits in terms of additional finances and so forth to protect affordable housing? There's lots of details that's going to be need to be worked out.
All right. Let me bring into the conversation Monica, joining us from Crenshaw Manor in Southwest L.A. Monica, how do you see it?
Hi, Larry. I really take issue with the Times article, and I think, like so many things, we take a concern that people on the left, progressives, care about legitimately affordable housing, and a solution gets proposed that serves every interest but those who would be most affected. So what I think is happening in this case, that developers get carte blanche to build where they want to build, and the units that they build will not be affordable. It's very clear that we have vacancy rates now at 45% in luxury housing. So the key to this is to create housing for people who can't afford it. As a single-family homeowner in Crenshaw Manor, this home has been in our family for four generations. We're not going to solve the housing, affordable housing shortage. Again, it's not a housing shortage. It's affordable housing. We're not going to solve that by building multi-family units next door to my single-family home and making my neighborhood untenable.
Monica, I appreciate your call. Monica in Crenshaw Manor, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org.